Welcome back to more of the Stuart Crazy Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Rob Nelson. And again, today I am joined by the Director of Interpretation here at Stuart Museum, Kay Sinova. Welcome back to the podcast.
It's good to be back again, Rob.
Well, the secret's out today, I think.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, because today we are going to delve into the complex history of secret societies in Hall County, but in the nation as well.
Yeah, we're kind of going to look at all aspects of it.
Now, everyone's heard of the dark secrets in the movies in National Treasure and Indiana Jones and the Da Vinci Code. But
God, I love those.
the real truth behind this, I think, is a little underwhelming.
Yeah, there's a lot to it, and there's a lot of them.
Yes, a staggering amount of them.
Yes.
Hundreds.
Yeah, secret societies are everywhere. If you go around a corner, you're going to find one.
Yeah, and they have a lot in common. Sometimes they share, you know, a religious affiliation, a political affiliation. But at their heart, I feel like most of them have one or two things in common, being essentially they're a fraternal organization that helps with social networking, insurance purposes for their members, funerary costs.
Yeah, they kind of got their start as chivalry groups, organizations kind of growing out of the Knights Templar. Masons is actually very, very ancient. And from what I have understood, looking at all of the different branches, the AOUW, IOOF, and all these, they all kind of follow the Masonic lines.
Yeah. What are the Masonic lines?
Well, they all of the practices, you know, there's different aspects of secret, kind of like secret ceremonies or rituals that the members go through that they're not supposed to share with anybody. But they practice, they help people in the community. They support people through sometimes insurance practices. Ancient Order United Workmen very specifically had a lot of like funeral expenses.
Sure.
You could buy insurance for that. We have a number of graves in the Grand Island City Cemetery that either it's noted in their obituary that the AOUW helped, you know, took charge of the services or helped with the burial expenses or something like that. Or there's just markers that just say AOUW and there's a number.
Sure.
And in some cases, we don't even know who's buried there.
Yeah.
Which is frustrating, but, you know, it's there.
Well, in our community, in Grand Island specifically, the Grand Masonic Lodge in downtown Grand Island is a huge marker in the community. Do you know where that's located by any chance?
Well, I grew up here. I've known where it's been all my life. I've always wanted to see inside of it, but never had the opportunity. But it's been here for a while.
Yeah, it's actually been here since, according to my calculations here, we are on location today in the Stern Museum archives. You can hear the shuffling of our papers. According to research, it was built in 1926 in Grand Island in our downtown. I believe it is 8 floors. According to an article from October of 1926 in the Grand Island Independent, when the structure was first opened, only the three upper stories are home to the Blue Lodges, Order of the Eastern Star, which is the female auxiliary of the Masons. Job's Daughters and the De Molays. Have you heard?
De Molays, yeah.
De Molays.
The De Molays, yes. Because I think the Job's Daughters are like the young ladies and the De Molay are the young gentlemen.
Yeah, so only the top three floors were actually used for those
for their
ceremonies,
meetings.
Mm-hmm. Below that, there apparently was an assembly hall reception auditorium.
Yeah, you probably have like a wedding reception there. I've never really actually looked to see if that was what really happened there, but they probably had all kinds of different assemblies and meetings.
Yeah, and all down the list, you get a little bit further away from the events or goings on of those organizations. You start to have regular businesses, and at the bottom level, you have a cigar store.
Yeah, storefront.
Or tattoo shop,
yeah,
or whatever
storefronts.
It happened to be.
Ooh, tattoo shop.
That's
in the 19th century. That'd be cool.
Early 20th.
Yeah, that would be cool.
But there's There was other organizations as well.
The really cool thing is, though, is that the Masonic, I mean, we have evidence that the Masons were here. They start showing up in the 1870s Grand Island newspaper. So the Masonic lodges, they were, let's see, my earlier sheet of paper here is from 1871, where they talk about the Freemasonry and chivalry, a comparison and conversation about that. But you look at 1872, there's already a listing in the Platte Valley Independent in July for the Ashlar Lodge. The S of T, whichever that is, and then the Southern Jurisdiction of the United States Kill-Winning Lodge Number 2. George Thummel was involved in that particular one. Actually, he was involved in a lot of this stuff. The dual chapter had Blake C. Howard as the high priest. P of H, the Aldergrange Number 7, they were holding regular meetings every third Monday. Lackenby, John Lackenby, was involved in that. And the Oddfellows were here, and that's 1872. 1874, we have the IOOF was here, as well as all the Masonic things. And then we have, I have my list here someplace. In 1883, we have AOUW, the Ashlar Lodge Dual Chapter, the Kilwinny Lodge of Perfection, number one. That's one to look deeper into, I think. Michael Murphy was involved in that one. Of course, GAR, which I don't know, you can't really call that a secret society because it was more a veterans organization. The IOOF, the Advance Encampment, number 13, Fidelity Lodge, number 935, and the K of H, I assume it's Knights of H, Knights of something, yeah. Knights of Honor, something like that, because it's also says Legion of Honor. They meet every Tuesday.
Yeah, there's just a constant stream of names from our own history that seem to be involved in one or another of these organizations. The Ashlar Lodge that you mentioned in 1871, I have an article here that states that the officers of that under the dispensation in 1870 were Robert C. Jordan, who was the worshipful master, mm-hmm. George E. Wilson, the senior warden, George H. Thummel, again, junior warden, and O.A. Abbott, the secretary, huge yeah. name in our community.
Yeah.
And on and on and on and down the list it goes.
When you look at the lodges they're listed in the city directories here, they're listed when their meeting times were regularly in the Grand Island Independent, but you also see that the names associated is kind of like a who's who in the kind of like the town builders of Hall County.
Yeah, and I think that's probably where the sort of the fear or anxiety comes from in response to that, to those sorts of connections. I think that a big part of people reading into the intrigue of these organizations is that anti-elitism vibe. You have countless numbers of lawyers, countless numbers of
politicians, bankers,
the businessmen of the era. And they all get together in these little rooms and the outsider just kind of starts wondering, what are they doing behind closed doors? And all those sorts of things start to escalate.
There's something about the mystique of a secret. I mean, a lot of these organizations, only aspects of it, you know, like the rituals and traditions that they carry on are secret within the organization. And everybody's, oh man, they must be doing something bad if they're keeping it secret. And that's kind of always been a fear about that, because nobody knows. Well, yeah, the thing is, nobody knows. And people will read into it what they perceive, whether it be good or bad.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, you know, there were some bad things that affected these organizations, one being the segregation issue. I think even still today, there are a handful of states that don't recognize the Prince Hall affiliate of the Freemasons, which is essentially the African-American component of the lodge organization. And that it's one of those places where segregation is still around, because these are private organizations.
Yeah, because the private are kind of governed differently. Well, and they also, they're because they have the separation, you know, we can't mix the gentlemen and the ladies, and we, exactly. You know, so that all has to be separate. So it's, the inequality is problematic, especially, you know, there's a lot of stuff that nobody ever really knows what happens, and,
exactly.
You know, so what, there could be bad things. Of course, that's fueled by Hollywood and some of the publications that have come out recently about things that have happened in secret societies, and some, you know, obviously there's probably going to be some secret societies that are bad.
Yeah. And just in Grand Island as well, you know, we had a Prince Hall affiliate in Grand Island, mm-hmm. with, you know, no less influential a name than George Flippin being a representative of that body. I believe the first African-American football player for the University of Nebraska. We also had the African-American female equivalent of the Order of the Eastern Star as well. So that, as you were saying, the divisions of gender and race, and in this case, in both ways.
Yeah. Heaven forbid that they should mingle.
Yeah. And then it's, you know, it's even more convoluted because you have like these semi-secret societies, like you were saying, the Grand Army of the Republic. And
yeah, because they had, you know, a lot of these, as I stated earlier, a lot of these were built on the foundation of the practices of the Masons, and they follow the, if you compare a GAR ritual for like services for the dead and everything, it's very similar to a Masonic one. So they borrowed between the different organizations.
Yeah. I came across an interesting story from the 1880s in our history, and maybe you're familiar with the White Cross League.
Yes.
This is an organization that sorts to kind of, it sounds like it's trending towards becoming a secret society within a church structure, but it doesn't quite go there because people are apprehensive themselves about.
Well, it depends upon if it was the religion that they like or the religion they didn't like.
Exactly. And some of these, you know, I'm pulling these daily independent articles from the 1880s. They're very hostile to the idea of this group. And I'll just give you a little bit of background by reading one article from February of 1888 as to what this looked like. The title is Bombastic Resolutions of the White Cross League Committee. A committee representing the White Cross League took occasion last night at the council meeting to offer a gross insult to His Honor the mayor of the city by a series of bombastic whereases and resolutions directed at his head, and endeavoring to shift upon his shoulders the responsibility for the failure of said members to perform their duty as citizens of Grand Island, owing it to themselves to do their part towards remedying the evils of which they complain. Not only was that bombastic, I am holier than thou, mile and a half preambles and resolutions insulting to the mayor, but it was also discourteous and disrespectful to the council, not even addressing or mentioning said honorable body, but treating the councilman with utmost contempt, which was due to the communication itself. And on, you know, on and on.
You had to enjoy how they wrote these articles in the Independent.
This sentiment came from, the article goes on, the sentiments of an organization composed of 400 of the best citizens of Grand Island, known as the White Cross League. We doubt the statement that the association numbers that it's challenging how important these people are in the article.
Yeah, like, do you really have 400 people? Are they really that important and influential? Because, I mean, everybody knew who pretty much the leaders of the community were back then, because it was a much smaller city at the time.
Yeah, and this organization was a Christian organization that sought to, it has five bylaws that we have a record of. One is to treat all women with respect and endeavor to protect them from wrong and degradation. Two, to endeavor to put down all indecent language and coarse jests. Three, to maintain the law of purity as equally binding upon men and women. Four, to endeavor to spread these principles among my companions and try to help my younger brothers. And five, to use all possible means to fulfill the command, keep thyself pure. There are countless articles that we have files on where this organization sought to sort of exert its influence in the community by kind of leaning on local businessmen to hire only clerks who would be loyal to the White Cross League and to kind of you know, hold up the ideas of being dry, I guess. Keep in mind this is in the era of the temperance movement. All things that are socially pure.
Yes, because that's why they were set up. The White Cross Army was an organization set up in 1883 by a philanthropist, Elise Hopkins, with help from the Bishop of Durham to promote social purity.
Exactly. At one White Cross meeting, one individual who happened to be there stated that he felt nothing had been accomplished yet in the ways of fighting the houses across the track, which was the reason.
Oh, we know what they were.
Yeah, which is the reason he came to the meeting. So he left a bit disgruntled with why am I here if we're not going to, in his words, fight the houses across the track.
Yeah, there is that little area up onto the other side of the tracks.
But anyway, just kind of to circle back, there are all these different organizations that kind of...
It's basically a lot of times that any of these organizations are going to be kind of like like-minded citizens who come together with very specific goals to try to attain. Some of them are benevolent, some of them not so much. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of not so much running around out there.
How common is participation in one or more of these organizations in the modern era?
I think it's less, and that is one of the articles that I read last night stated that they started to see a decline in participation in these organizations as other entertainments became available, like movies and television.
Oh, sure.
And that type of thing. They started to see their numbers decline because a lot of these organizations, if you look at when they meet, it's going to be every Thursday night, every Wednesday night, every other Wednesday night. So it was like you could belong to multiple organizations and have something to do pretty much every night of the week to kind of like fill your time. So if you have other things to do, maybe you don't need to belong to that organization anymore. Maybe there's no real reason to belong. Certainly there are still some organizations that are around today that are doing okay. The Elks, I mean, we have an active Elks, and I don't really know anybody who's a member of the Masons in Grand Island. I know somebody who's a member of the Elks, but not the Masons.
Well, and at a certain point, maybe some of these organizations have fulfilled their purpose. I'm thinking along the lines of, look at something like the Plottage or the Liederkranz, the German social fraternal organizations that are in Grand Island now. They came about originally as kind of networking
For anybody who spoke high German or low German,
to have that sense of belonging to community. Mm-hmm. You can see sort of that same thing happening with something like the Knights of Columbus. And not that they have, I guess I misspoke and said fulfilled their purpose, but the reason that they came about was to provide a sense of community for people who
and support. It helped to support newcomers to the community.
Yes.
It helped them gain footing in the community in that. So they did serve a purpose, a really good one, to kind of help people get organized. Then they helped members with the funeral expenses, or there were certain members that in one case I just did on Find a Grave, it was really sad. He was very, very involved in the AOUW, and he died suddenly. And his family was left destitute, and they had a special needs child. And later on, he died. Well, members of that organization also helped to pay for that child's funeral down the line. And that was over 10 years later.
Wow.
So they were still supporting. They were still helping.
That's incredible. I'm thinking of, you know, I was just talking about the Knights of Columbus. And that really starts as an organization for essentially Catholic people in America who are
kind
first
of like
generation.
A counter statement.
Yeah, to the anti-Catholic bigotry, for lack of a better word, happening in America at the time in the late 19th century.
Late 19th, early 20th century. There was a movement against immigrants and Catholics.
Yeah, so the cat, like members of their own diocese and local regions begin these organizations known as the Knights of Columbus. They choose that name for a specific purpose, which, you know, in modern historical circles has to do with this idea of whiteness, mm-hmm. where they choose Columbus as this person who is Italian, who is Catholic, who is the discoverer of America, in order to kind of reclaim that idea of patriotism for themselves, to say, hey.
And that was the ideal of that time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Columbus has become problematic in all sorts of ways today.
Big time problematic.
But at the time, you know, we're talking late 1890s. That's around the time of the 400th anniversary of the quote unquote discovery of America by Columbus. So there's all sorts of patriotic vigor going around
because
the nation.
We have the Columbian Exposition in Chicago and all of that stuff is happening. So there's all this support because at the time it was thought that he discovered America and all this other stuff. And it is only more in modern times that the true stories are being told. So, but the Knights of Columbus, I grew up as Catholic and always, you know, they were there for funerals and certain services and stuff at the church. And the costumes they were were pretty cool, I thought. But, you know, I was a kid, so.
No, absolutely.
Like the hats.
But, like, that, all of that kind of pageantry and stuff was giving the
idea. It was pageantry, and it was different, and it was unique. So,
and to show, like, a legitimacy to it and all the rest. But is there anything else we need to delve into? I think we kind of threw a hurricane at all the topics.
Yeah, we did. But this is a very, very deep topic that has been studied by countless number of people for over 100 years. There's a lot of people who are researching these societies and looking into them. There's still way more conspiracy theorists who have all kinds of things to say about the secret societies. I don't feel that I have a place to judge because I don't know. I can't be a member of the Masons. Sure. I can't know what's happening in there. But I also, you know, it's not really my thing. So I haven't been involved in that type of stuff. But I do like who doesn't like a good mystery and the... what are the secrets and all that kind of stuff. And so the intriguing things about some of the modern books and films that have come out about some of these, they're just interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And they can't necessarily be proven wrong since the people can't become members.
That's right.
Themselves
you
a lot
either
of times.
It's like, and I think that the Masons and a lot of these organizations are used to having a bunch of shade thrown their direction. They're used to having people saying, well, you guys do this and you guys do that. And all they do is cross their arms and look at you and go, you know,
tough,
yeah. You know, not going to tell you a thing.
Well, as you said, we just scratched the surface. We could do an episode on each one of these organizations just by themselves and then probably a 5-part series on.
More than likely. But we're going to have to delve into that research. I think it's going to take a little bit and then we might not be able to find out all the answers.
Yeah. But rest assured, Grand Island and Hall County in general and Nebraska even more so has a complex history with all of these organizations
and more.
Yeah. And we definitely encourage anyone who's interested to reach out to Stir Museum or your local historical society and kind of see what's hidden beneath the surface.
Yeah, start a research project. It'll be very helpful.
Yeah. Okay, Casanova, thank you so much for stopping by again for this episode of the podcast. Hope to see you next time.
Thank you, Rob. Always fun.
Yep.
Hey, all you Stuart crazy listeners. Did you know Stuart Museum has a bistro? That's right. You heard correct. Now available in the Leo B. Stuart Building, Stuart Museum visitors will have the chance to partake in an assortment of delicious options for meals during the day of their visit. With selections like artisan sandwiches, paninis, wraps, and a rotating soup and salad menu, it's a must after a long, hard morning. Oh, you say you're more of a fan of pastries and desserts? Well, the Bistro has more than enough items to satisfy your sweet tooth, In fact, whatever your reason is for visiting Stewart Museum, the Stewart Bistro is a must. You'd be crazy not to.
And we are back with more of the Stewart Crazy Podcast. I am joined today now by Carly Kramers, the Director of Education here at Stewart Museum. Welcome back, Carly.
Thank you. Happy to be here. We have a very intriguing topic today.
As always, I hope. Well, we just heard from Kay about the local side of things to the secret society movement situation in America. But now we're going to kind of branch out and talk about the national side of the story. And so I thought I'd bring in Carly because I know you have a special interest in a handful of these stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, hearing anything about like the words secret societies, I feel like so many things pop to your head about, you know, imagery from movies and people in cloaks and, you know, what could possibly be going on back there. And so what actually is going on can range from many different things based on whatever organization you're learning about. They are far from all the same from with each other. So it was interesting to learn about a handful. And, you know, obviously we can't learn everything about these secret societies.
For sure.
I personally am not in a fraternal organization.
No.
So I can't tell you any personal things, which I'm sure if I even was a part of one, I don't think I could probably talk about it on a podcast. So
no. And you know, and it's really slippery because, yes, there are those secret societies, but then there are like private societies. And like, so I'm a member of the Liederkranz in Grand Island, which isn't a secret society, but it is a closed society for German, you know, people with a German background, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So like what Kay and I kind of got into was just like, there's so many levels and so many different branches and branches within the branches, and they're divided by race and they're divided by gender and they're divided by class and they're divided by city and town and precinct and diocese and et cetera.
Yeah. So, and there are things today that are considered not secret societies at all that at one point was a secret society, such as Christianity. The whole thing
used to
be a secret society because when it was originating and with the Romans trying to squash it, that was something that happened in secrecy. And so it was considered a secret society, but is now far from a secret society.
Yeah. And this was so interesting to one early sociologist in 1901 that he wrote in the American Journal of Sociology, whose name was B.H. Meyer, that he uncovered at least 500 national beneficiary orders and thousands upon thousands of local lodges.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, back in, I have a statistic from 1901, 1 in 5 men over the age of 21 belonged to one or more of these secret societies. So that could be like clubs, fraternities, orders, mystical worlds, friendships, tabernacles, temples, all of those different words that go about that. And so you can also imagine that there are many people from throughout history that have been in one of these fraternal organizations, especially like the further back you go when it was at its peak. Various presidents from the Freemasons alone. There was George Washington, and then there were others of Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Harry S. Truman, Andrew Jackson, Benjamin Franklin, Harry Houdini, Mark Twain, Louis
John
Armstrong.
Wayne. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a topic that, you know, I think gets the most press, and it is super interesting. And I think a lot of, you know, the conspiracies surrounding these, especially the Freemasons, everyone, that's the big one, right?
Yeah.
I think it comes from that sort of, there's this high class group of people, they have all the power in government, they have all the power in business or politics or whatever. So there's this sense of, this is my personal opinion, I might have learned more through osmosis, but just there's a sense of elitism that they're also in this club and I can't be in the club. So what are they doing in that club?
Yeah.
And I really think that's where the secrecy or the negative feelings towards the secrecy comes from.
Yeah. And then when you like see these lists of people that have had significant power that like also happened to be part of these fraternal organizations, it's like, were they a part of these fraternal organizations because they had power and potential, or did they have power and potential because they were part of these fraternal organizations?
How far down the rabbit hole do you want to go?
Yeah, exactly. And I found, you know, some interesting things with the Freemasons specifically. And this was a response that I got from when I did a band camp one time with a girl whose dad was a part of the Freemasons, and I mentioned, like, oh, isn't that a secret organization? And she said, well, they're not a secret society, but they are a society with secrets. And I was like, oh, you just, like, piqued my interest even more. That was such a good response.
Way to defuse my question.
I know. Like... I was like, oh, such a good answer. But then I also found out that that is a standard answer about the Freemasons. Yeah. So she wasn't just, like, an eighth grade girl that was like, here's this little cryptic message for you. But there, I found an article from the Times where it was titled, What Freemasons Taught the World About Power of Secrecy. And this is such a good quote where, so Freemason secrecy, which gives this feverish imaginings free play, is like the water at the bottom of a well. The men who built the well know how deep it is. The rest of us can only peer down and wonder what might lurk below, while the dark surface mirrors back our fears. Once again, another quote that I'm like, oh, that's so good.
If I could kind of get into the other side of things, which is the anti-Masonic movement, because we've mentioned a few of these names, one in particular, Andrew Jackson, who was a Mason. He actually was president during a time where this huge anti-Masonic movement sort of came about in American history and actually birthed a third party in American politics. One of the first third parties actually in American politics, the anti-Masonic party.
A whole party.
And they had a presidential candidate in the 1832 presidential election that actually won the state of Vermont and 7% of the popular vote.
Wow. I would have never imagined that, like, fraternal organization movement would become a whole political party with candidates and everything.
I think we all remember William Wirt as the candidate that was denied the office of president in 1832.
Oh.
We're all very familiar with everything about him, aren't we? He's such a popular guy.
Yeah, totally. I ran off the top of my head.
Neither am I. I just learned that yesterday, that there was a person named William Wirt and that he was a presidential candidate for office.
Proud of him.
To kind of back up a second, the reason that anti-Masonic feelings sort of arose, there was always, like we were talking about, that sort of aversion to the mysticism and anxiety or fear or whatever you want to call it about the group itself. But there was an event that happened in 1826 to a disputed Freemason whose name was William Morgan, who was threatening at that time to publish a book on exposing all the secrets of Freemasonry to the world, and he was going to shine a light in a dark place. Mm-hmm. And when news of that came out, he was then kidnapped under mysterious circumstances, was never found again.
Oh boy!
He may have been killed. There are rumors that he was seen living in other places after this time that were not confirmed. There's also a body that washed up on shore. A few years after this incident that was, like, claimed to be him.
Wild.
And really no one ever knows, no one ever found out what really happened to this guy, William Morgan, but essentially four Masons were tried and convicted of kidnapping him.
Oh boy.
And one person, Eli Bruce, who was a local sheriff in the place that this was happening, served 28 months for the initial kidnapping, and three other Masons were also charged with the kidnapping, served lesser sentences. But that was a really national, huge controversy that sparked the birth of a third political party. I should also say, in kind of getting into the political weeds here, 1832 was at a kind of important moment in American politics, because the two-party system of that time was kind of collapsing a little bit, and it gave an opportunity for different views to kind of gain some traction and to become a party in itself. Mm-hmm. And they ultimately, the anti-Masonic party, merged with the Whigs, and they became like the other party. At that time, it became the Whigs and the Democrats.
Okay.
But it was before then the National Republican Party, and the National Republican Party died and became a consolidation of multiple small little wings, and one of them was the anti-Masonic party.
Gotcha.
That was a lot, but
basically it was a time in history that, like, allowed for these more specific interests to birth up as, like, a whole party.
Yeah. And there's other elements to it. There's anti-immigrant sentiment, there's this and that. They started as a one issue party that tried to become more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately just got swallowed up by a bigger movement. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah, but I mean, I think what you were kind of getting at right there about, like, you know, anti-immigrants, and there were, and I mean, in certain organizations still today, there definitely are some things that we could view as problematic seclusion to who is allowed to be a part of these things, which I think also adds to people wondering, you know, what's really going on, if they're going to be so exclusive on who could come in based off of things such as gender, race, ethnicity, class, all of those. And I think that it makes, you know, people wonder more and sometimes have a bad taste in their mouth about these different things. And I mean, we're talking these bigger fraternal organizations, but also something I think of with fraternal organizations are frats, like in colleges.
Sure.
And I feel like that's a really visible example of how some organizations are having to face consequences for what they've been doing with hazing and certain ceremonies and certain things that have been going on that members will keep hush hush and say, well, this is normal, this is part of our culture and what happens here. And then it gets out and people are saying, that's actually very bad and we need to stop doing that. And so I think seeing it on, like, this collegiate level adds to the, well, are there other things going on in other organizations at that level that people just don't know about because of that secrecy?
Yeah. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about the Masons. There are a lot of other organizations that are, you know, they have things in common with the Masons. They're a fraternal organization, but they draw from a different group or class of people. Like you said, fraternities and sororities. A lot of those times, those do kind of still have those elitist mentalities, just, or not mentalities, but perceptions by the larger public, or at least at moments anyway. I'm not saying that's necessarily accurate or not.
Well, I mean, like, you have to be selected to join it, and, you know, there might be different abilities or expectations that you have to meet. So
yeah,
it's like a smaller level that I think everyone is more familiar with because it's in so many different college campuses that we see.
Yeah. And the one of them that kind of differs from that, I guess, is the point I was making, is the International Order of the Odd Fellows.
Oh, yeah.
Is, like, that name kind of speaks for itself in that it was kind of a conglomeration originally of trades and guilds that didn't really quite fit in anywhere else.
Island of Misfit.
The founders were boat builders, a comedian, a vocalist, just like kind of these guys who are, yeah, I do a little of this, little of that, and they weren't the high profile people, and they started this Odd Fellows organization in the early 19th century, and that ultimately at one point it became the largest fraternal organization, even larger than the Freemasons by the late 19th century. It had, in 1922, there were 2,676,000 members.
Wow.
That's a huge organization.
A lot of Odd Fellows there.
Yeah, exactly. But, and, you know, like, in some of these organizations, they follow the times that they're in. This, the International Order of the Odd Fellows, was an all-white organization until 1971. And then they get rid of that sort of exclusionary rule to open it up to other races, et cetera. But that kind of mirrors the times that they're a part of because they've been around for such a long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there are other cases, too, of people who aren't welcome into a certain society making their own different branch. So the Benevolent Protective Order of Elks of the World, a.k.a. the Elks Club, as we've heard of them.
Oh, sure.
In, like, 1897 was a time where they would only take people who were white, and so some people went and made an African-American fraternal order called Improved Benevolent Protective Order of Elks of the World, which I think is very fun that they just, like, added the word improved on there. I mean, there are various fraternal organizations out there that, you know, are, I mean, less explicitly so than what used to be, but are still predominantly a certain race. And so, you know, it's one of those things, too, where people are calling out these different places. And even the idea that, like, why are there fraternal organizations? Like, why can't I go and join some of these places just because I am a woman? And I, like, what goes on behind closed doors? And, I mean, there are cases of, you know, some of these organizations having heavy use of alcohol or misogyny and just, like, spreading that hyper-masculinity thing of, like, oh, you don't need to be at home and taking care of the children, and your wife's just going to nag you. So come on over here and we'll have some beverages, and then you can go home drunk and have a good time and a good nap, and then we can do it all over again tomorrow.
Yeah. And even see, like, in just how slippery these subjects sort of are. You mentioned the division between white and black in some of these. Within the Masons, there's the Albert Hall organization, which is essentially the Freemasons, but what started out as the segregated branch of the Masons that, you know, even in the last few years, were still not recognized by the regular Freemasons in several states of our own country because they're private organizations. I was talking with Kay about that in the last section of the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, like, there are fraternal organizations out there that, like, you know, are wholesome in the fact that they just purely wanted to go and have altruistic means and work together and do fundraising things and raise money for children and all that stuff. But then there are ones out there that I feel like fester on and are successful because of those internal, like, we are we, the others are the other. So mm-hmm. we need to make sure we are with one another and can protect one another and have a safe space for us to be ourselves in a world that's full of the other.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that one reminds me specifically of the Knights of Columbus, which, you know, originates in the late 19th century as a kind of response to the anti-Irish, anti-Catholic mm-hmm. sentiments that were present in the country during that time. That's a specifically Catholic fraternal private society, mm-hmm. the Knights of Columbus. And they also did a lot of great things for their members. I'm thinking specifically of after World War I, they created an employment bureau of their own to find returning veterans of World War I jobs mm-hmm. throughout the country. There were as many as 1,700 counties throughout the country that participated in this for the Knights of Columbus to help soldiers when they were at sea on their way back home fill out cards that said, like, oh, who are you? What job experiences do you have? Where would you like to work? Those kinds of things. And then they had, you know, people within their various departments kind of hunt down opportunities for them so they would have a job and they got back from the war. Like little like things like that that you wouldn't necessarily associate with organizations were happening and still continue to happen in many cases with these organizations.
Yeah. Fun fact, I grew up in Columbus, Nebraska, and I was so confused when I found out they had Knights of Columbus in other places.
Oh, yeah.
I really thought that it was just a Columbus
thing.
Yeah,
why wouldn't you?
Yeah, we had Knights. Cool.
Yeah. I mean, I'm from Lincoln originally, so everything was named after Abraham Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln. So
yeah.
You would have thought he was from there, but.
Right? Who would have thunk? That was a side note. Sorry. But yeah, it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all for fraternal organizations, and there are some that are, you know, opening their doors to be not fraternal organizations and opening up women or people of various gender identities. But then there are still ones that, you know, probably do things the same exact way as they would have in the 19th mm-hmm. century. It's just kind of like you can learn about them, but also you can only learn so much about them because they're societies.
Well, I think we can pause it there. As we both know, this is just really a skimming of the surface of this very, very incredibly complex, incredibly deep, multi-layered mm-hmm. onion of a topic.
Yeah, I feel like if we ended up continuing to do research, we would probably go down rabbit holes quickly and end up some crazy conspiracists.
Exactly. And that's where ultimately does end up.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but for now,
skimming the surface is nice.
Yes.
Well, the water.
There you go. Well, yeah. Exactly.
Going back to the
original quote, coming full circle one last time. And on that note, I think we can pause.
Yes.
And this has been a great episode on the History of Secret Societies. Join us again next time for more historic content from the Stuart Crazy podcast. Thank you so much, Carly Kramers, for joining us. And
you're welcome.
We'll see you next time. Thank you.